Everybody, that is certainly a wonderful wake-up music call for all of us. I'm Beatty Cohn-Fredhaus, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beatty Show. And for those of you who may be actually tuning in for the very first time, although I am actually hosting the Ask Beatty Show here on the Progressive Radio Network, I can hardly believe it. It is over 8 years since I first met Gary Noll. How time flies, which is why it is so very, very important that we are committed and serious about living our lives in ways that are really and truly in our best interest. And of course, there's a reminder that we have to remind ourselves, I think, all the time, and that is to say no to the things, people, and places that steal our joy. Well, I'm a psychotherapist and a sex therapist. I'm the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships. And I say this all the time. I only wish that I had had this book when I was first starting out in my own dating and relationship life. It would have made my life a lot easier, which is actually why I have been spending more and more time in the high schools, because we really need to prepare our children, not just for math and science and going to college, but relationship education is really, really key. You can have houses and cars and trips, but if you are not in a healthy, loving relationship, we're all really asking for a lot of trouble. And my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, was based on some research that I did a number of years ago in the Boston, Providence, and Connecticut area. I did research with 450 people who were really willing to be honest with themselves and honest with me about relationships. And as a result of the research, I devised a 10-step formula. And for those people who know me, you know that I am very, very bottom line. I have no patience for psychobabble. We want the truth. We want to really encourage people to do things that actually work. So my formula teaches us how to assess. Yes, assess. It's not sexy. It's not romantic. But of course, it is critical. How to assess who is right for us and who is also wrong for us before committing to any serious relationship. And one of the things that was so upsetting for me about the research was that I discovered that it takes about a year to really find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. And again, for people who know me in my personal life, I'm probably one of the most impatient people that you could probably ever want to meet. Of course, professionally, I am incredibly patient. But that is the reality. We really do need to play out the points of the match, so to speak. And obviously, if we're seeing a lot of red flags, we need to give ourselves permission to exit before we actually allow our relationships to really do us in and potentially destroy us in all kinds of ways, emotionally, psychologically, physically, medically, and financially. So again, the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. I'm also the advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons and also in Palm Beach. I write an Ask Beatty column, 2 to 3 columns every single month. And what's so great is that people have been writing. I've been writing the column for almost a year and a half right now, and I've been getting all kinds of questions, of course, mostly about mental health issues and relationships and sex. And, you know, hopefully, you know, when I do the show, when I see patients in my private practice here in New York City and in East Hampton, I mean, the goal is, at least for me, is that perhaps that there are some little thing that I can say that can really help people to turn the switch and get on a really constructive path rather than living their lives in ways that are self-destructive and self-sabotaging. And, you know, after the book came out initially, it's been out in a couple of editions right now, I was sort of waved into the national radio and television scene. And basically, you know, people will say to me, well, you know, you're on TV, you're on radio, but it's really all the same. It's about educating. It is about being committed to trying to help people live the best possible lives that they can. But of course, people need to be serious about this. I cannot make people want to change the trajectory of a life that is not going well. And I think for the majority of people, there really does need to be, at least what I've seen during the past 35 years as a practicing psychotherapist and sex therapist, there really does need to be a bottoming-out point in their lives before I feel that the majority of people are really serious and are willing then to acknowledge and address and resolve.
Yeah, I can't hear her.
Issues that are getting in the way of their lives and their relationships. I think we're having a technical problem here.
I got it. I'm sorry, it was on X. Okay, I'm good.
Okay. Yes, my guest is awaiting her own introduction in a few minutes. I think we're all having to become much more savvy when it comes to dealing with all of this technology. It's amazing. We push a button and all of a sudden we can hear one another. But anyways, the first Beatty Show, it is about empowerment. And what do we talk about? Well, we talk about all the things that we can actually do to improve the quality of our lives and our relationships. We talk, of course, about mental health issues and sexuality. And again, my mantra, and I'm hoping that it can actually become your mantra as well, is that we all need to be willing. We need to be willing. We need to be serious about acknowledging and addressing and resolving as best as we can, even though we can't change our history, the things that do continue to get in the way of our lives and our relationships. And what I hope I've convinced you over all these years is that we don't need to take this journey on our own. And that reaching out to family and friends, if you're lucky enough to have loving, supportive, healthy family and friends, I mean, that's a wonderful place to reach out to people who really care about you. And if need be, professionals. I mean, it's not a weakness. It is a strength when people make the decisions that they need a little bit of extra help. Because the thing, too, that I have found, and I ask people to really do this on a daily basis, is that we need to do an accounting, not just once a year, of our mental health, of our relationships, of our sex life, our lifestyles, our money, our work, our sleep, just to make sure that we are really on track, that we are really on a constructive path versus a self-destructive, destructive or self-sabotaging route. And whether or not we're talking about addictions to alcohol or prescriptions or recreation drugs, it takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of honesty to be willing to make changes in our day-to-day life. And even though, and I want people to understand this, is that even though we cannot change our histories, we have an opportunity every single day to reboot and pivot and become mindful of the things that we actually can and need to do and not do to nurture ourselves, which will enable us to live the best possible life. So I am so pleased to meet a woman who I am meeting now for the very, very first time on Zoom. Her name is Jane Fox. And Jane is an NYS certified recovery peer advocate. And of course, Jane will let us know what that is. And co-founder of Nerali, NERALI.org, a sobriety resource for the Long Island Jewish community. And Jane brings the depth of experience from living on both sides of the sobriety fence to support groups for family members with a loved one struggling with sobriety. And this is also something that I'm really interested in talking to Jane about, is that she advocates structured culinary workshops that they be integrated into recovery programs. So welcome, Jane. Very nice to see you. Very nice to meet you. And I love your book. You're able to hear me okay?
It's a little bit of a delay, but I'll do my best.
Okay, and your book is The Hungry Mother, Recipes for Recovery and Life in the Kitchen. So again, welcome. So I have a lot of questions that I, of course, want to ask you, and putting on my psychotherapist hat, I really want to begin at the beginning and ask you, when did you actually realize or begin to realize that you yourself had a problem with alcohol?
Well, when you're young, you generally don't stop until you hit a brick wall. Right. And I hit the brick wall in, I'm embarrassed to tell you how many years ago, 1976.
Okay, a few years ago.
I was a young woman, and I had been active for a couple of years, and family took a very harsh role with me and didn't mandate, but I had to go into a residential treatment program in New York City.
Wow. And, So it sounds like that if that had happened, that your drinking must have been pretty much out of control for your
family. Actually, I was a heroin addict at the time. I really blew the roof off of a nice Jewish girl from Great Neck.
Right.
And I was kind of on a mission. I guess I misunderstood the 70s to be just go crazy, and some people went to communes, and I was on a pharmacological safari of doing as many drugs as possible. I thought it was adventurous and made me cool. And then, of course, your world comes crashing down, and I got sober, and it was a lot of emotional work. I was very lucky to be in a program which is kind of in existence, but not in its original form. And it was called a therapeutic community, where you live with other addicts for an extended amount of time. It's unfortunate there aren't many of them around anymore. I think that is the most effective treatment, but that's all I'll say about it.
So do you actually believe that you're beginning to use heroin and other drugs was just because you were looking for the adventure that so many people in the 60s were experiencing, and of course experimenting with all kinds of things? Do you think it was about that, Jane, or do you think it was really also about other things as well that may have been going on or not going on in your life and in your family?
Well, I was very lucky. I grew up in a very, in an affluent home where appearances on the surface, it looked great. Right. There was no trauma, but I think I had a lot of anger or I was just lost. And I've been through so much therapy in my life. I don't even really know what caused it isn't really the issue anymore because I'm past that. But suffice to say, there were underlying causes, but none of them were really dramatic. It was just the luck of the draw. I will tell you what was dramatic was I grew up in a household where taking a pill was commonplace.
It was
almost like Valley of the Dolls on Long Island.
So then sort of moving into other drugs wasn't so different. I mean, it was a degree of difference, right? But it was just kind of more of the same.
I wasn't afraid. There was no fear in our household. If you had an ailment, you were given a pill. If you had pain, you were given a pill. If my father couldn't sleep, he took a pill. If my mother was anxious, she took a pill. And so as a young woman, even when I was menstruating and would complain of cramps, my mother would say, here, take a pill and go to school. And here's an extra one in case you need it during the day.
Interesting. So that's what you learned early on about how to deal with pain and how to deal with anger and upset, is that you take a substance of some kind. So in your family then, would people, for example, you know, you mentioned when you started your period, would your mom sit down with you and talk about what this was really all about? That this was a new phase of life, or was it just if you had a cramp, you should take a pill, and there wasn't a lot of conversation and dialogue?
And not a lot of conversation. And also, as a young child, I had very bad asthma. And in those days, they didn't have inhalers, and they would give you codeine cough syrup to stop the coughing.
Right.
And, you know, that was like the miracle drug in my household, because I would have severe attacks and they would say, oh, quick, give her the codeine.
So you were taught, I mean, we're not talking about blaming anybody, but you were really taught and sensitized to reach for the pill or the substance to deal with virtually, it sounds like, almost all of your ailments, fails, ailments, upsets.
Right. And I witnessed, you know, my mom, you know, who really was very involved with tranquilizers as I was growing up and into her old age.
I see. So you actually grew up in a home where there was substance abuse, or at least a lot of substance use.
Yes. Thank you for that.
Right. So tell me, I mean, so what's your drug of choice initially? Was it actually heroin?
It was anything I had, like sleeping pills, you know, I don't even remember. It was, you know, we smoked marijuana, but I would, you know, experiment with different pills that I found in my parents' medicine cabinet.
And you liked it. Did you like the feeling, obviously?
I loved it.
You loved the feeling.
Loved the feeling. I felt emotionally released. I felt, impenetrable. I felt powerful. Sometimes before you go to that nod out stage, you feel empowered, you feel comfortable. Right. And it's a form of energy.
Yes. At least short term.
Yes.
Now your parents, do you have siblings, or are you an only child, or
what? My sibling is as straight as the day is long.
So do you think that she had different parenting than you did? Do you think
she witnessed? She witnessed my downfall.
I see.
And it scared her, and she saw the turmoil that it created in the family.
So your parents, did they? I don't want this to sound like a therapeutic, you know, interview. I want this to be something that people are going to be able to learn from, and that there's going to be a takeaway, and that it's going to be good for you, Jane. I mean, that's why I occasionally have guests on the show. So I'm wondering, did your parents realize that their little girl was really in big trouble here?
Yes, they figured it out. I mean, you know, the warning signs were there. In college, I had to drop out because of my grades. And each time that I came home on a vacation, you know, I would, you know, fall asleep. I mean, they knew what was going, they figured it out.
So how old were you when you first began to use, whether or not it was, you know, too many aspirin or Valium? How young were you when this all began?
I was in my senior year of high school.
I see. Did anybody else know outside of the family, teachers, guidance counselors?
No, because it wasn't overt at that time.
I see. So then what was there, you know, an event, so to speak, that really got your parents to a point where they realized that their little girl needed some serious help? Did something happen?
I came home from a vacation with a huge scar on my leg. I had fallen, like, and I said, I fell on a playground, and I needed several stitches. And when they saw the scar, they said, that's it. You're seeing this therapist where I was going to school. And luckily she was very intuitive. And the other side of it, I was in nursing school. And
interesting.
And yeah, her office was in the lobby of the psychiatric hospital that was in part of the nurse's rotation. And I saw her like 4 days a week, very Freudian, you know, and where you don't even see her. She's behind you. You're like stream of consciousness.
Oh, my.
And I finally admitted what was going on because I was getting scared because I had started using needles. I was using it. And the relationship I was in at the time, I realized it was very dangerous. And I didn't know how to extricate myself. So I confided to the therapist and she suggested that I take a couple of days off and go admit myself voluntarily. And then the rest is history.
So how long were you in a residential program for? I mean, here you're in high school. You would have been, what, about 18 years old?
No, actually, the story kind of snakes around from when I was in college. And I came home from that hospital. I had 5 psychiatric hospitalizations between that time and when I went into program.
Wow.
And in those days, hospitalizations were the way they treated substance abuse. You had a mental illness.
Yes, exactly. Did you find that the hospitalizations at that time were helpful? I mean, was there a positive experience, a positive takeaway?
It was terrifying because you're with crazy people. I knew I wasn't insane. I just wanted to get high. So you don't really pay attention to the therapy, but it's different now than it was back.
Yes, exactly. So it was kind of like a revolving door for you, going in, going out. Did you continue on with your Freudian therapist for a number of years? Did you work with other people or what?
Well, after I got out of this 3-month stint in this hospital in Pittsburgh, I kind of drifted home. And for like a few years, I lived at home and then I moved out west and I thought I was okay. And I would still dabble, but I wasn't really a full-blown addict until I came back to New York for family reasons in the mid-70s. And then I started using heroin on a daily basis. And
did anybody know what you were doing and that you were
not really pretty secretive, and I think kids today are even secretive. I mean,
absolutely,
it's a hard thing to pin down, and I tell parents and family members just to use your instincts. You don't need proof all the time. Go by your gut.
Exactly. So you came back to New York. Your parents, were they kind of unaware that you were in trouble again?
They had an idea that, well, I had already been in 2 different hospitals, and they had an idea that I was still struggling. And then I announced to them that I was moving out west, and I moved to Arizona. I came back, and when I came back, that's when I started using heroin every day. And they did a very creative intervention. I saw a family friend who was a judge, Wachler, chief judge of New York State, was, yes. And he was very strict with me, and he knew me, and he said, either you go into this program in New York City, this Ariba, or I'm mandating you to a psychiatric hospital upstate. Those are your choices.
Uh-huh. So that was that the beginning of your serious, or at least seemingly serious, attempt to try to get on a constructive path?
Definitely. And I think, and I say again to parents, be as strict and as stern as your instincts tell you. You don't always need proof that there's stuff going on, because if there's not, then they turn out okay. But if there's something going on, you really need to do an intervention.
Right. So what do you think it was about this program as compared to other programs, or maybe it had to do more with your readiness at this point, that proved to be helpful?
I was very lucky. It was founded by a very kind of radical psychiatrist called Dr. Dan Casriel, who had founded Daytop with Monsignor O'Brien back in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
And that was the start of therapeutic communities on the East Coast. There was Phoenix House, Daytop, Synanon, and a couple of others. And it was long-term. But what he did, this was private. He did this therapy on the mats. It was called Accelerated Reeducation of Emotions, Behaviors, and Attitudes. And you would literally cry your guts out on a mat a couple of times a week and get those nasty feelings out. You would cry, you would hug, you would scream, you would hit a pillow, and it worked.
Right. Right. Because as you were saying, there were a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions that you had about all kinds of things in your life that initially were taken care of, so to speak, by taking a pill or taking a drink or shooting up. Right.
Exactly.
So this was the first time then that you were able, with help, to really get in touch with what was going on inside.
Get in touch with it and then get rid of it.
Right. Right.
Scream it out. He used to say, scream it out, scream it out. And
yes.
If you walked in the building during a session, you would hear people screaming.
Oh.
And then literally, the year that I was there, Network, that movie where people would open up their, New Yorkers would open, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yes. Yeah,
Patty Chayofsky, his son was a resident, and he also came to groups himself.
Uh-huh.
So that was exactly how it worked.
Interesting. Now, during this time, and by the way, how long was this particular program?
It was a full year.
Wow.
Of living there. It was a little townhouse on 51st Street between Madison Park. It looked very benign from the outside, looked very corporate.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But there were 30 kids living there, and after being there for a year, you had to get a job. You had to get a job. You could leave the house every day, and then after having a job for 3 or 4 or 5, 6 months, you were able to move out, but you still had to come back 3 times a week, 4 times a week. It took a lot.
It took a lot and very structured, and obviously it was that structure that you really needed at that particular time. Did you have a lot of support from your family, your sister, friends, as you were going through such a difficult transition?
At the time in the 70s, it was very alienating. Drugs were a really bad word. Mm-hmm. And I was a very small percentage of the population. So I was, not that they didn't comfort me, but I felt like an outsider for many years.
Uh-huh. And were your parents on board with you as you were going through all of this?
They were as supportive as they were capable of. Let's leave it at that.
Right. No, I understand. So after you left the program, Jane, how did things go for you?
It was, living in New York City and working. I was very lucky. I got a job at an ad agency.
Uh-huh.
And I was so happy to have a phone on my desk. My God, because when you were living at the house, you got permission to make a phone call.
Of course.
I ended up getting to work early, staying late, whatever I could do to make me feel like a real person again.
Yeah. Now, were you able to huge transition from this program. So now you're working in an ad agency. Now you're living on your own. Was it difficult initially on a day-to-day basis to stay clean?
Not at first, but after a while, I would say getting into my third year, I felt challenged. Challenged by romance. I knew I wanted to get married. I knew I wanted to start a family, but I still kind of pinned the scarlet letter of shame and didn't feel that anyone normal would want to be with me.
Uh-huh. And how did you, and hopefully you have, how did you go about working through the shame and the self-blame as you were moving along this really very constructive path?
That's a good question. It was like a double-edged sword. I could begin to feel my accomplishments. I could begin to feel that I was in a great work situation. I was meeting new people. But meeting new people in the 70s in New York City, chances are somebody was drinking or smoking or doing lines. It was, especially in that world of advertising, it was a challenge. And that's what was starting to make me feel insecure. I'll never meet someone who doesn't drink and doesn't do. How am I going to meet a sober person?
Right. So were you continuing with outpatient treatment or therapy as a means to support your new journey?
I definitely was a part of that family, that Ariba family. And I found a lot of comfort because you could go back and relate to those people and say, I feel like an oddball. I feel like a freak. Who's going to want to be with me? And everyone understood what you were talking about.
Right. So what about love and romance? Again, at that point, were you able to... So my question, I'm not sure whether or not we froze the question, but were you then able to make some really good relationship choices for yourself as you were continuing on a more constructive path than you had been on previously in your life?
Well, at that point, I was almost 30 years old and I was not feeling, and also you have to remember, AA was not in the vernacular at that time.
Right.
There was still a huge stigma, and it was a big secret. And I felt a little bit like a junkie. I had to keep my life, my real life, private. I couldn't share.
Right.
So I ended up, and of course this was my bad decision, I ended up marrying the person who was the director of my program.
Wow.
I would be safe.
Overstepping boundaries, perhaps?
Well, I had been graduated for about 2 years.
I see. Uh-huh.
And it was just, happenstance. And I was very, we had a great relationship for a few years. I won't say many, but it fit the bill. There was no judgment. And I thought I'd have my own in-house counselor.
Right. How long did your marriage last?
8 years.
Uh-huh. And then during that 8-year period, were you sober? Were you?
Oh, yes, sick? Absolutely. Yes, so, I was sober.
Uh-huh.
I was sober for 15 years.
Really? So the relationship, even though it ended and it may not have been the best relationship for that period of time, it kept you in a reasonably good place when it came to the substance abuse issues that you had.
And also I had worked hard to move into the world. And After I worked at an ad agency, I got another great job at Sotheby's. And
really?
Uh-huh. Yes, and it was a very exciting time. It was when it was still on Madison Avenue. It was getting ready to move over to York, and record prices, and it was just a very exciting time, and I really felt like a real person again. I felt like a real woman. And this relationship was nurturing the respect that we didn't drink, we didn't do drugs.
Right, right. And that was a huge plus. I mean, that was exactly what you needed during that period of time. So after the relationship ended, were you able to stay on this very constructive, healthy path in terms of not using?
No, that's when everything fell. I had two young children.
I found
out while I was pregnant that my ex was leaving me for someone else. And I lasted about a year after that. And then I couldn't sleep at nights. It was a disaster. I was, my whole life was shattered. And I had a very beautiful home in Riverdale. I had everything that you could want. I had two lovely children. And my ex left me for another woman. I found a very sympathetic psychiatrist, and he prescribed sleeping meds for me, and that was it. It was over. That I went off to the races.
Uh-huh.
And
that's amazing that he would have done that, given, when you think about it, right?
But I wasn't honest with him. I didn't tell him what my reality was.
We're not honest. Okay, I get it. I get it. So there you were again, back into your old ways, self-destructive, self-sabotaging ways. And how long did that last for, Jane?
About, I want to say, over 2 years, it was at least 2 years. And then my life was really falling apart. It was clear that I had issues, and I had gone to see an attorney about, marital, divorce issues. And thank God he was in the program, and he took one look at me. He goes, "Listen, lady, I'm not going to help you unless you get sober first."
Well, who've had significant substance abuse issues. So go ahead, Jane.
And I was very lucky, and my parents actually helped me find probably the best psychiatrist in New York City, the most brilliant addiction psychiatrist. He's head of NYU Langone.
Who is that? Is he still practicing?
Yes, Dr. Mark Gallanter. He's on the Upper West Side. He was brilliant, and he knew me. He had my number. He knew, and it was humiliating. I had to come in. I had to bring friends in with me. I had to tell everybody what my issue was.
So go ahead, James.
And I had an infant and a toddler. My children were, I would say they were 5 and 1. Or actually, they were probably older. They were, let's see, they were, I think, 6 and 10. And I lived in a lovely neighborhood, and I had some really dear friends, and he made me bring 3 friends twice a month to ask for their feedback as to how I was doing.
Wow. I love it. I already really, really am going to call him as soon as this show today is over, because as I say, I need to find somebody who I really like, respect, and trust. So were you able to, manage, as a mom? I mean, being a mother under any circumstances is always challenging. I mean, how did you manage?
It was the hardest thing I ever did, Beattie.
Of course, Jane. Of course.
It was the hardest thing, but the emotions were so deep. I always wanted to be a mom. And here I had dragged these two innocent victims along with me. So I wanted to get better. I had to get better.
Here on the Progressive Radio Network, I want them to be able to hear about Hungry Mother, because you say,
I can't believe how we're
cooking
fading.
Cooking and recovery. significant connections between cooking and recovery. And you're talking to somebody who's never cooked in her life, never will cook. So I'm so eager to hear. I'm so eager to hear what these significant connections are that it really have helped you to stay clean and to live a good life.
Well, I'll tell you, it was the best way to connect with your children. Like, you had to make a meal. And what better platform, what better, you know, table than to show them you care? Because they witnessed my addiction. They knew something was wrong with mommy.
Right.
And you just couldn't come back in and pretend nothing had happened.
Right. I mean, you were really juggling so many things. You were juggling an addiction. You were juggling being a parent, being a single parent at this point. You were juggling having a job. I mean, it's amazing. And I hope you've been able to really pat yourself on the back and say, oh, my God, look at what I've done. And more importantly, look at all the things that I've done in the last number of years to get my life on track. I mean, are you proud of yourself, Jane?
Well, I think that's why I wrote the book, Beattie. That's why I wrote the book, because I really wanted to redeem myself. Because I think I didn't feel all those good things that you say.
Right. You feel them now, though.
Yes. And I feel empowered by the message. Because let's face it, there aren't a lot of old ex-addicts around. And I felt that I had something valuable to say. And also, I got to say things in the book that I've always wanted to tell my children, that I did it out of love for them. My love for them is what saved me.
Mm-hmm. And what was their reaction to mom writing a book?
They haven't really discussed it with me, to tell you the truth.
Well, that would be a very interesting conversation to have with your children. I mean, hopefully they are very proud of mom for writing the book, for staying on course. And you are on course, right? Now?
Oh, absolutely. I co-founded this NORALI, this Northeast Recovery Alliance of Long Island.
Uh-huh. What is
about
that?
5 years ago. And that was my way of telling parents who have children, you know, how do we deal with this? How do we cope with this? How do we help our kids?
Right.
They were proud for me as a result of that, because I felt I had to give some kind of message of hope, because it worked for me. I mean, never give up.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I think that it would be wonderful if your children, I mean, have they read the book? I love
it. No, they got through the first chapter.
I wonder too, not in jest, whether this is something that's probably very painful for them, you know.
It might be. And they know my story. They pretty much know my story. And that's one of the chapters. You have to be honest about your recovery reality with your children. And when you admit that you're in recovery to the children that you parent, it's a great moment. It's a scary moment, but it's a watershed event.
No, exactly. And tell me, how have many of your, friends, colleagues, family members, how have they reacted and responded to your honesty and your courage in coming out and telling your story? Not an easy story to tell.
I know. It was funny. I told Cheryl, the publisher, I said, when the book came out, all of a sudden I was mortified. I said, everyone's going to know my story that I've kept hidden for so many years.
And because we know many of the same women, Jane, how have people responded to you and your courage?
I think they like the book as a good read. I think it's a cautionary tale.
Right. I mean, I would hope that people have really, expressed how brave you are. But it's true in telling your story, taking the time to write this really moving book. By the way, the book, The Hungry Mother, Recipes for Recovery and Life in the Kitchen. And you have succeeded. I mean, that's the bottom line. You are a success. Your story turned out, you turned it around and made it successful, yes. Your life successful.
Yes, thank you for that. And well, and that's, you know, that's the hope, really. I you know, my message is to, you can always turn it around. Nothing is not, everything grows back. Everything can be rejuvenated. And right. The mother-child relationship, you know, it never dies.
Exactly. Tell me, is this maybe one of the best times of your life right now?
That would be sad. No, actually, I'm very happy. I feel at peace in terms of I've put this issue to bed. I feel redeemed, and it brings a certain kind of peace. Like I put it out there in the hope that it can help other people. And let's face it, in today's world, there's so much going on, and if I can contribute, and the substance abuse for women, for mothers, has grown by leaps and bounds, especially uh-huh. during the pandemic. And, you know, there's children wanting their moms back, and the moms, you don't want to pass on a legacy of choosing drugs over your children. That's a deadly message. That's a horrible message to pass along. So I want everyone to feel that they can redeem themselves.
Right. And, you know, what I've found over all these years is that, unfortunately, for most people, for most of us, we do really have to bottom out before people get really, really serious about changing behaviors, changing lifestyles. And unfortunately, we need a lot of pain for most people to get to that point to really want to do the work, which is never, ever easy to do. And it's not fun. And it's not like going out and having, you know, just a fun tea party. It takes courage. It takes stamina, which obviously you have and obviously you've exhibited. I mean, are you able to really take that in about yourself?
I'm working on it.
Good. I'm glad that you're working on it. Tell me, is there any final takeaway that you would like for my listeners?
I would say, you know, just to tie it into the cooking, that's how I reconnected with my children. And at the same time, I established healthy patterns for myself. And after you make a great meal, you can pat yourself on the back. I was proud of myself. Look at what I made. Boy, it tastes so good. And, you know, and I can do it all. I can really, I cooked my way back into my children's world and showing them that I was the mom again. Uh-huh. And when I worked with people in recovery down in Florida, when I managed halfway houses, when they incorporated, they had always had a culinary component. And these were people living in halfway houses, and they lived there for a while. That just, if you could get into cooking and manage your life, budgeting yourself, going, buying the right groceries, keeping your refrigerator full or cleaning your kitchen, and you could make a meal for a friend, that was a great way to bond with other people. Mm-hmm. Inviting someone over for a meal or bringing something to someone's house. That was the start of a good life.
Right. And of course, you know, with the cooking, you're talking also about that human connection, which, and of course, there is nothing more important than human connection that we have, which you've been able to, it's interesting, you've been able to take the cooking and the love of the cooking and bring the love to other people, to your children, and probably also to friends and
yes, family. Yes. And that, and I get love back, and then I feel worthy, and then I'm proud of what I, you know, I'm proud of myself for all that. That's how the self-esteem started for me.
Exactly. So had you not discovered this cooking recovery connection, wow, I mean, I wonder what would have happened. I wonder what the end of the story would have been.
That's hopefully a story that won't have to be told. It saved me.
Exactly. Are you still mindful, Jane, every day that there are certain things that you need to do to keep yourself on track over?
Yes. Yes. I have, you know, there's always a moment, it's obviously not every day, where you feel unnerved, you feel unrest, you feel doubt, whatever those feelings are. And I've learned over the years, I've developed good habits. I love to walk in nature.
Right.
You know, go for a walk, call a friend, right. And if that fails, make something on your stove, bake something in the oven, and that can pop you out of a bad mood.
Right, exactly. So you've been sober and clean now for how many years in total?
Oh, geez. I got sober again in 94. I've been sober, a sober mom for 25 years and 15 years, almost 40 years.
I mean, that's really something to celebrate.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
We should have a huge celebration with all the people that we know. I mean, it's a huge deal. And, you know, I really want to thank you. I mean, and I'm sure everybody would feel the same way in having the courage to really talk about it in this way.
It was so nice speaking with you, Beattie. You're helping me, like, get that self-esteem going.
Well, any time. But, I mean, I'm not just saying this to be nice. I mean, people who've been in dark places, it really does take an enormous amount of courage to do the work, you know, and to come out on the other side. And it sounds like, I mean, you've been incredibly successful. I mean, if you look at your history, the prognosis, you know, with somebody who was doing the things that you were doing, it would have been very, very shaky.
Yes.
You managed. I mean, you should be a hero for a lot of people, certainly for your children, but it's true. And I do hope that you're really taking in what I'm saying. And I'm not just saying it again because I like you and because we know a lot of the same people. I mean, you've really done, you know, an amazing job in turning your life around. And I'm really looking forward to meeting you one day very soon, Jane. We'll have to figure
yes.
it out.
Yes. So thank you so much for having me on today, Beattie. This is
thank
really a
so
great
much.
Experience.
Take care. Take care and have happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, everybody, that was Jane Fox and her book, The Hungry Mother, Recipes for Recovery and Life in the Kitchen. You know, you talk about a very, very courageous woman. Well, I can hardly believe that it is 3:55. How the time goes when you're talking to somebody where there's some real substance to be discussed. And I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. And the first, which I feel is probably the most important message that we need to continue to remind ourselves about every single day, is to make sure that we are living our life in ways that are really in our best interest. And yes, that means doing ongoing assessments to make sure that we are really on track when it comes to our mental health, when it comes to our relationships, our sleep, our physical health, our diet, and making sure that if we're finding that we're getting off track, that we're going to be able to stop ourselves. And of course, the very best thing that we can do is to reach out to people who love us. And there are a lot of people who are alienated from families. You know, I'm reading statistics, 30% estrangement with families here in the United States. So don't see it as a weakness, but see it as a strength if you're finding that you really do need to reach out and get some very good, great, actually, professional help. So we have to do everything that we can possibly do to stay the course and to make sure that we really do love ourselves. And secondarily, with the holidays and the craziness that goes on in our world, we all need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to come together and learning to love each other. Well, again, I want to thank you all for listening. It's been over 8 years, and I can hardly believe it, that I've been hosting the SBD show here on the Progressive Radio Network. And I want to thank my terrific producers, who I actually met for the first time last week when I was interviewing Dr. Andrew Solomon at the studio. You take very, very good care of me and very, very good care of all the other people who are hosting shows here on the Progressive Radio Network. So I want to wish you a good, good rest of the day. And we'll be able to talk next Monday and every Monday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on the Ask Beauty Show on the Progressive Radio Network. So again, have a really good, good, good rest of the day. And I hope that Jane Fox's takeaway will be something that will be very, very helpful for any of you who are suffering from substance abuse of various different kinds, or who know people who may have issues and problems with drugs. So again, thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll talk with you next week. Goodbye, everybody.